Geopolitics and Empire is joined by Stephen Starr, former director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Professor Starr is an associate of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, has been a board member and senior scientist with Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's worked with governments in support of their efforts to eliminate thousands of high alert launch ready U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons. His work has been published by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the Federation of American Scientists, and many other organizations. He maintains the website nuclearfamine.org. Welcome to Geopolitics and Empire, Professor Starr.
Thank you for having me.
I've been following your work. You're doing a lot of great work. And I think to start, maybe Professor Starr, is it'd be good to get your pulse on the state of the world. You know, we've got the war in Ukraine, which is a proxy war between East and West, between Russia and its allies and the US, EU, and NATO. We are in de facto a nuclear World War III scenario. I continue to hear more and more forecasts by military and media from both sides discussing the inevitability of World War III, tactical mini nukes, red lines, and so forth. I came across a clip this week of famed Russian, Russian politician Zhirinovsky, who's made many accurate forecasts, and he predicted World War III for 2024 starting in Iran. And so what's your assessment of where we are and what's going on?
Well, I think you summed it up pretty well, actually. I've been focused on the war in Ukraine. And, you know, the idea of are we in World War III now, or is it about to start? I guess it depends on how you define World War III. It seems to me that the United States has been pushing to the point where, you know, U.S. NATO surveillance, U.S. satellites, AWACS planes are providing real-time targeting information to the Ukrainian military forces. We've sent, I think the war would have been over there probably in March last year, but at that point, the U.S. and NATO made this a massive commitment to send unlimited amounts of weapons, basically. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed since then. So I see that as a war crime in itself, really. I don't know. I think if you have to define World War III as when the U.S. and Russia have started direct military conflict, well, we're not there yet. But that line, you know, the fact that drones were sent to strike the Ingalls Air Base 370 miles inside of Russia, where the Russian strategic nuclear bombers are kept, and that happened twice, you know. And surely the information was provided to the drones on tracking information from the U.S. satellites. And I wouldn't be surprised if we supplied the drones as well. So this can be considered testing the air defenses of Russia and their military bases. And I mean, you know, in a sane world, that would be considered an act of war, and we wouldn't even think about it, you know, if we don't want to have a war with Russia. But I get the impression, and what I really worry is that the leaders in Washington are so wrapped up in their own propaganda, and they're so uninformed about the realities of nuclear war. I think they might think they can win a nuclear war, and I can explain that later if you like, that they have no qualms about getting to the point where they put American and NATO military forces in Western Ukraine because they think Russia won't dare to attack them. And, you know, that's when we're going to really, when push might come to shove as far as the direct military conflict is concerned. So I don't know. I think that if we're not in World War III, I would say that we are already. But, you know, the shooting between the United States and Russia, their military forces hasn't started yet.
And I'm hearing like reports, there was a clip this week, I think from Sky News, I don't know, remember it was a British and American official basically saying we need to start direct war with Russia. I mean, these people are crazy. And, you know, and another thought of mine, other developments that I'm seeing now most recently was South Korea discussing, you know, possessing nuclear weapons with the flimsy pretext of, you know, North Korea and China, while at the same time, I mean, I feel it's the U.S. egging them on because the U.S. is now attempting to create an Asian NATO. You know, Kim Jong-un and the Chinese have come out and warned about this. And so we're now seeing this, you know, proliferation. Well, you've been working against this proliferation, but now we're seeing South Korea saying, yeah, we might need to have nukes as well. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, both Japan and South Korea could probably become nuclear weapon states in a very short period of time. When Biden was still vice president, he did an interview where he stated that Japan, quote unquote, could literally become a nuclear weapon state overnight. And, you know, why Japan's got thousands of pounds of plutonium that they could use to make tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. A virtual nuclear weapon state can be defined as a nation that's created all the components of the weapon but haven't assembled it yet. And I'm talking about Japan. You asked about North Korea, but you know, I know more. South Korea is in the same place as Japan, but I think, Japan passed a state secrets act. It was shortly after Fukushima, and that made a 5-year prison sentence for anyone publishing. Well, it's 5 or 10 year prison sentence for the publishing or divulging of nuclear related information. And everyone assumed that was about Fukushima, but I think it was because Japan has a clandestine nuclear weapons program. And Germany and Japan, if you look at their constitutions post-World War II, they're not supposed to have, armed forces, that are going to be going into other countries, or especially if you would have thought about them developing nuclear weapons back then, I think that would have scared a lot of people, but it should scare people now. I don't know. I don't know what's, as long as the nuclear weapons race continues and the nuclear weapon states keep nuclear weapons as a cornerstone of their arsenals, that's going to set the example for the rest of the world. When I did work at the UN for a while as an expert witness and on the effects of nuclear war, and some nations there consider the non-proliferation treaty as a nuclear apartheid. It's okay for the five original nuclear weapon states who are also permanent members of the Security Council to have nuclear arsenals, but it's not okay for other nations. And that's not going to last. And you can see that's eroding in South Korea and Japan.
A quick shout out to our sponsors, which you can locate via the sponsor page on geopoliticsandempire.com, or whose links are included in every podcast description. I've tried privacy phones in the past, such as Silent Circle's Black Phone, which turned out to be a dud. The best and really only option so far is de-Googling your phone. Now, you can do it yourself, but I've never had the time to figure that out and simply got an above phone. They sell de-Googled phones that come with a suite of software. They also provide support and a monthly above privacy suite with many features such as a unique phone number, encryption, email, VPN, and so forth. If you're looking for a private phone, check out Above Phone. Make sure to click on the Above Phone link on geopoliticsandempire.com or via the podcast description so that we can enjoy a commission. Also, check out the Nomos Time Bank at nomos.net, which you can download in Spanish or English to your Apple or Google or de-Googled phone. Nomos allows people in your community to exchange services using time as a currency rather than fiat money. This will be one great way to survive in the coming algorithm ghetto. If you need health insurance, you can talk to my friend James Guzman of the Borderless Blog Podcast and Health Insurance. He offers free consultations. Simply schedule a time with him over at borderlesshealthinsurance.com. Finally, you can donate directly to Geopolitics and Empire, consult with me, the host, or become a member to join private monthly member Zoom calls where we shoot the breeze discussing world events.
Another important issue when it comes to everything we're discussing are the removal of the different safeguards, the arms control agreements. One of my professors in Geneva School of Diplomacy, Yuri Nazarkin, was a chief negotiator at the START and ABM talks. We've seen the U.S., I believe under Bush, end the anti-ballistic missile treaty. Open Skies has been dissolved. And now there's talk again of the new START, the U.S. saying Russia isn't really responding to further discussions regarding the new START. What are your thoughts on the removal, the continual removal of all of these different arms control agreements?
Well, the Russians describe the Americans as non-agreement capable. And, that has to do with the U.S. abrogating basically every arms control agreement they've made with the Soviet Union and Russia except for New START. And the ABM treaty that George W. Bush backed us out of in 2001 or two, that was a cornerstone of a lot of weapons treaties. And, you know, that led, you know, Russia was very upset by this. And you know, Putin in 2007 addressed us in a speech in Munich and said, you know, we're going to respond to this. And basically their response was their development of hypersonic weapons that the U.S. has no. We're decades behind. We can't even field a prototype, and the Russians are on their second, third generation of these. So that's a byproduct of all the falling apart of these. But it's even the Iran agreement. You know, we backed out of everything that was going to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons. But so I don't know that, and that goes. And then you add that to the fact that Merkel and Allende and Poroshenko all confessed that they had no intent of honoring the Minsk Accords. You know, all that adds up to Russia saying, well, why would we negotiate with you at all, whether it's over a new start or Ukraine? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think any reasonable person, if we put ourselves in the shoes of the Russians, we'd feel the same way. And just on the note of hypersonics that you brought up, I've seen some pieces from the mainstream Western papers recently doubting the Russian hypersonic capabilities. I saw a response to that by Andrei Martyanov, who's been a guest on my podcast, the Russian American military expert, and I would tend to agree with Martyanov that the hypersonics do seem to be the real deal. It would maybe be difficult for the Russians to kind of fake what they got going on with the hypersonics. I mean, your further thoughts on how hypersonics are
they're a game changer. The first place you should look at is how these affect U.S. carrier battle groups. I mean, we have no defense against a swarm of hypersonic missiles coming at them. Absolutely none. So, any wartime situation. And, you know, China has borderline hypersonic anti-ship missiles, too. So our big carrier battle groups are going to be as just like the Nord Stream pipeline, as Victoria Nuland mentioned the other day, a hunk of metal sitting at the bottom of the ocean. We all we see today is magical thinking in so many areas, and whether it's military policy or economic policy. I even had a physics professor write me saying, oh, the Russians don't really have hypersonic weapons. And I'm just like, how can somebody like that even make a statement? But, if they don't believe in them, wait long enough and one will be coming through their office window one of these days. You know, I've heard the same argument we mentioned earlier before the broadcast started about some people say there are no such things as nuclear weapons. And I just like, well, really, what? Maybe you should talk to the Marshall Islanders about that. You know, that they can't go back to where they live anymore because it's still so heavily contaminated, and all the Kazakhstan and all these places where people suffer from the effects of it.
That was one of my points, because I'm open to a lot of things, but today things are just kind of going. There's a trend, the accelerated trend, where people are discussing, you know, flat earth and then saying viruses don't exist and the nukes don't exist. And it's like, I understand that a lot of these things are hype.
We can print endless amounts of digital currency to solve any problem too, right? There's no limit to it. Right.
Yeah. I might pick your brain on the CBDCs at the end, but I lived in Kazakhstan for 3 years. I was employed by Nursultan Nazarbayev at the Nazarbayev Intellectual School. I lived in Semey, 120 kilometers from the Polygon, 18,000 square kilometer principal Soviet nuclear test site. I've been there with the nuclear scientists. And, I visited one of the many ground zeros because, supposedly they dropped 500 plus bombs, and I had my Geiger counter. It was, radioactive. And so I don't see why they built out all of these makeshift underground metros and above ground buildings like as models to see. I just kind of see it far fetched that they would go to all that length for something that was fake. No,
I think that's one thing you can dismiss, the idea that there's no such thing as nuclear weapons. I wish we could, though. I wouldn't have to spend all my time worrying about it. I'd much rather be working out in my orchard, you know, or playing piano or something like that. Because it doesn't make for a great life to always be thinking about nuclear war, honestly.
Yeah, and to get back to that, then we were talking about hypersonics. And another point is we're seeing, again, both sides discuss the use of mini nukes or tactical, you know, nuclear weapons. And it seems like the West especially is pushing that. There's talk of Putin possibly using tactical mini nukes in Ukraine. What are your thoughts on these devices?
This kind of relates to the idea of what they used to describe as limited nuclear war that American war planners came up with in the 1980s, or escalate to de-escalate. You know, we're going to shoot off a low yield, you know, nuclear weapon that will show the other side that they have to back off. And, you know, the Russians and the Soviets and the Russians always laughed at this. I said, well, you know, I say, have fun with your war games, fellas. But, you know, every war game that NATO fought, if it ever got to the point where nuclear weapons were used, they call it a fire break. That always escalated into full-scale nuclear war. I mean, and that I had a colleague named Colonel Valery Yurinich, who was a colonel, and he was on the Soviet general staff for 7 years, and he helped design the Russian nuclear communication systems. And he told me once, he said, you know, if we ever have anything like the Cuban Missile Crisis again, I don't think we're going to survive it, because right now, you know, with our launch-ready nuclear weapons, back then they were just developing ICBMs, and our hyper-communications, it just, everything would happen too fast. And as far as hypersonic weapons are concerned, you know, there's the Russians have outfitted one of their frigates with those, and they're supposed to go on their subs pretty soon. Well, if you can get a sub like 100, 150 miles off the coast of the United States, you know, Washington, D.C. is like less than 100 miles from the Atlantic coast. And a Zircon missile travels at Mach 9. That's like 112 miles per second. I mean, you know, I would think, well, 112 miles per minute. I'm sorry, I have that wrong. But, you know, all it takes is 3 or 4 minutes for something like that to hit Washington, D.C. And if you look at how long it takes to do a threat conference, you know, it's like you have to, NORAD has 3 minutes to detect the launch and report it to the command authorities. And then you have to contact the president, and he might be given a 30-second briefing. If he issues a launch order, it takes about 2 minutes to issue that order, and it takes about 2 more minutes for the ICBMs to fire. They're called Minuteman missiles in the U.S., the land-based missiles. And those are always kept powered up and ready to launch. They always have launch crews at the consoles. So, but that still takes, you know, 5-6 minutes for that entire process to occur. So if you can hit Washington, D.C. or, you know, in less than that time, then there isn't even time to do all that. So that creates pressure to have a preemptive strike, really, on both sides. If they know, because there's always been a fear that, you know, the communication systems are vulnerable to a nuclear attack, and the idea of use it or lose it, you know, comes into play. The Russians have what they call, it's nicknamed the dead hand system, it's perimeter. It's consists of some soldiers in a buried facility 60 miles away from Moscow, and they are always in contact with the National Command Authority. If they detect, they think there's going to be a launch, they'll warn them of a impending strike. They'll warn the launch crew. And then if a series of things have to happen almost simultaneously, they have to have a loss of all communications with the National Command Authority. And then they also have detect nuclear detonations through seismic, radiologic, and optical detection systems. If all those things, and it all has to happen about the time when the nuclear attack was supposed to occur. But if that happens, then the launch crew will launch emergency communication rockets that will overfly any surviving Russian nuclear forces and issue a launch order that won't require humans to launch them. So it's a semi-automated device, you know, kind of like a Dr. Strangelove kind of thing. So that's all, you know, the U.S. always has 4 Trident subs in what they call hard alert status, where they're in position to fire. And each one of these subs can carry 24 submarine launched ballistic missiles. Those missiles can carry up to 10 warheads. You know, under New START, they're only supposed to carry maybe a maximum of 3. but you know, how do they know if they're uploading them or not if we're not doing inspections anymore? And so this whole situation becomes increasingly more dangerous. And you know, in peacetime, there's been many false warnings of attack, although they started classifying those in the U.S. in 1985 after a faulty computer chip in the NORAD headquarters put a training video on the main screen showing a massive ICBM attack on the United States. And they had rolled the lids back on the silos, and they were getting the president on the phone when they finally figured out what had happened. So that's a kind of world that we don't know about, that Americans are not taught about. We don't teach it in schools anymore. My students that I have at the university, I teach a class on nuclear weapons. They don't even know the difference between an atomic bomb and a thermonuclear or hydrogen bomb. So it's so we're in trouble, but people don't even know it.
Yeah, I don't know if you were referring to the book. I haven't had time to read it yet. 1983's Abel Archer, one of those.
I've read about that. Yeah,
right. And you mentioned those, especially in the West, thinking they can win nuclear war. And a past guest of mine, I think it was back in October, Vietnam veteran Bob Moriarty, who's a semi-regular on Geopolitics and Empire, who's flown 800 plus sorties in Vietnam. He's flown under the Eiffel Tower and set records flying across the Atlantic. He's echoing the same sentiment as you, that some of these folks in the Pentagon or in Brussels think they can win nuclear war. Could you sort of walk us through
what they're thinking? If you go back to 2006, the Council on Foreign Relations published in Foreign Affairs this article called The Rise of U.S. Nuclear Primacy by these two academics, Lieber and Press. And that basically said that the U.S. could, with a U.S. nuclear first strike, they could take out all of Russia's nuclear ability to retaliate, 100%. Well, that raised a lot of alarms in Russia. My friend Colonel Yurinich contacted me, wrote a rebuttal to that. But, you know, that started the thinking that the neocons, I mean, the Russians look at the Council on Foreign Relations as kind of, you know, if they say it, then that's what the government's thinking. And I think about 9 years later, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists published an article about the new fuses on the Trident D5 missiles that allow the warheads to be three times more accurate than the previous missiles were. So the war planners believe this gives, you know, two Trident subs the ability to with a first strike to take out all of Russia's land-based ICBMs. And they have, you know, a large percentage of their nuclear forces are in their ICBM silos. That's what I worry about, is that the people at the White House, Victoria Nuland, Blinken, Sullivan, they're really neocons. You know, all you have to do is listen to them talk. I mean, they seem convinced that they can threaten Russia and Russia will back down. And I think if they have in the back of their mind this basically false information that they can win a nuclear war with a first strike, then we're really in trouble. You mentioned your mentor who was in the Arms New Start negotiations.
One of my professors, Yuri Nazarkin. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in 2010, I believe it was, they had at the UN, they had the hearings, a briefing on the New Start Treaty that Rose Goetmuller and Anatoly Antonov gave. And I had a pass then. Back then, you could get in better than you can now. They don't want people like me floating around. But I went in they gave the briefing in the main auditorium, the main hearing center at the UN at that point in New York. So I sat down in a seat that I think I sat behind. It said said France. So I think they thought I was a member of the French delegation. I raised my hand after their briefing and asked them a question. I said, are you all familiar with the new peer-reviewed studies that predict full-scale nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia will basically wipe out most people on the planet? And Antonov said, no, I'm not familiar with that. And Goetmuller said, well, I'm not familiar with any recent studies, which meant that she had heard of the nuclear winter studies in the 1980s, which were basically subject to a big smear campaign. And everybody was convinced that they were bad science. Even anti-nuclear weapons people did. New studies came out in 2006 and 2007 that showed that the original studies actually underestimated the environmental impacts of nuclear firestorms. even with the reduced arsenals at that point, because the arsenals had gone from 70,000 weapons total in 1986 to, you know, maybe 20,000 at that time. Right now, we have about 12 or 13,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, and the U.S. and Russia have 90-some percent of those, probably 92, 93%. So at any rate, I was kind of astounded. These are the people that are in charge of our future of nuclear war, and they don't know about nuclear winter. I wrote a paper for the Federation of American Scientists that was published in 2017, I think it was, called Turning a Blind Eye Towards Armageddon, U.S. Leaders Reject Nuclear Winter Studies. And the basis of that title was a good friend of mine, Greg Mello, who works, you know, runs the Los Alamos Study Group, and people should look at that website. He knew people that knew the people that make the decisions, and they said, no, they've rejected the idea of nuclear winter. They think it's bad science. So that's where we are. We have at least U.S. leadership that does not believe in the peer-reviewed forecasts of the long-term environmental destruction of the planet from nuclear war.
Yeah, and that sort of brings me to my next question. You've been speaking a lot about this, as well as with visuals. I'll include some of those links in the description on sort of the worst case scenario. And just to mention Nuland, we're all familiar with Nuland, who said, F the EU. And I think she's the same kind of person who would say, F the world, and, you know, hit that shiny red button. And
F Russia.
Yeah, which would be pretty much F the world. And, I get that image from Terminator 3, where, you know, Skynet becomes self-aware and launches all countries' nukes, and you can see the map, all of the, you know, nuclear missiles just destroying the planet. And what, you know, what would be the, because as you said, like, we wouldn't stop at a, you know, just a couple tactical nukes, it would just escalate to all out nuclear war. And then the effect of that, and, you know, just a question, because when I visited the Polygon, again, I went for like a day, you need a number of days to do a more detailed visit of the Polygon out there in Kazakhstan. And I just was kind of surprised as I was driving, we were driving like an hour in to the Polygon, and we stopped for a snack, and I checked with my Geiger counter, and there was no radiation until we got to ground, one of the ground zeros. And it was only for a small patch of land, like, a couple of meters, it was radioactive. And I don't know if they cleaned that area up, because I also do have that concern. How bad of an effect would the nuclear winter be? And how come, you know, in my visit, apparently it didn't seem so bad, the radiation. So if you want to just talk about
that. That's a good question. You need to differentiate the issue of radioactive fallout from nuclear winter. The mechanism of nuclear winter is basically these gigantic firestorms are ignited by a nuclear detonation. Russia has 500 of these 800 kiloton warheads that they have ready to launch at the U.S. at any given moment. And each one of those warheads, I wrote an article for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists about the effects of one of those weapons if it was detonated over New York City. And it'll, on a normal weather day, it will ignite fires over an area of about 150 square miles, which would be, I always think in miles, but I think that's about 389 square kilometers. Because a nuclear weapon's like a piece of the sun when it goes off. It's not, you talk about explosive power, but it really is like a small sun being born in the atmosphere. And it ignites fires over a huge area, simultaneously. And all those fires within tens of minutes will coalesce into a gigantic mass fire. And the flames from that fire will rise up at hundreds of miles per hour, which will cause winds on the periphery of the fire to rush inward at that speed enough to uproot trees and suck people into the fire zone. And, 10 or 15 minutes, the air temperatures in that fire zone will be well over the boiling point of water, like 200 to 260 degrees Celsius or 400 to 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So no one in that zone is going to live. That's one bomb. So if you shoot off 500 of those, and U.S. strategic nuclear weapons, they begin, their explosive power is defined as beginning at 100 kilotons or 100,000 tons of TNT. And they go up to over a million tons of TNT. So the U.S. and Russia have around 2,000 of strategic nuclear weapons that they can detonate within an hour or so. So the worst case scenario that I've described involves, you know, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 of those being detonated. And that produces, the scientists have predicted that like 150 to 180 million tons of soot and smoke would be created by these firestorms. And it would rise. It's heated by the sun. That was what they discovered in the studies in 2006 and 7. It's the smoke. It's black carbon soot and smoke that's heated by the sun. That it's like a solar collector. It heats up and rises above cloud level into the stratosphere, where there's high winds that will cause it to circle the Earth in a matter of a few weeks. And eventually it forms a global stratospheric smoke layer. And that smoke will, that smoke heats up there. It actually gets to the boiling point of water. And that facilitates the destruction of the protective ozone layer. But it also blocks warming sunlight from reaching the surface of the Earth. And they predict 70% of the light in the Northern Hemisphere and 35% in the Southern Hemisphere would be blocked, which would, within a few weeks, create temperatures colder than they were 18,000 years ago at the height of the last ice age. Temperatures would be below freezing every day for up to 3 years in Central Eurasia and Central North America. So you wouldn't be able to grow crops for a decade. Some people, I think, would survive, but others, most wouldn't. And land animals would be wiped out. It'd be a mass extinction event. And notice I didn't talk about radioactivity in that. You know, that I don't bring that up in these lectures because, you know, that, you know, why worry about radioactive fallout if we're all going to starve to death? But I do want to address the radioactivity. You know, one thing that's never talked about is what happens if you target nuclear power plants in wartime. We've seen a little bit of that in Ukraine with Zaporizhzhia. You know, the nuclear industry doesn't want to talk about that entire subject. They just say, well, this shouldn't be allowed, you know. But there was an English lord that made a comment that if there had been nuclear reactors in Europe before World War II, nobody would be living there now. I think it was fairly accurate. If you target nuclear power plants, they have not only the radiation in the reactor core, but also the spent fuel pools where they offload their used fuel. It's changed out every 3 years or so, about a third of the reactor core. And they don't have long-term geologic storage for it, so they keep it on site in this tennis court size pool that's 40 feet deep, that's got 3 to 5, in the US, like each spent fuel pool has 3 to 5 times the amount of radiation that's in the core, that's in the spent fuel pool. And US reactors have those pools outside primary containment. Russian reactors have it inside, but that makes it even more vulnerable to disruption. You know, to if the fuel is not cooled continuously, the heat from the radiation and those fuel rods will heat the water to the point of boiling, and it'll boil down to the point where the tops of the rods are exposed to steam or air. And at that point, the rods will rupture, and if they're recently removed from the reactor core, they'll ignite. And there was a study that showed an area the size of, like South Carolina would be made uninhabitable from a single spent fuel pool fire. So if you hit reactors with nuclear weapons, you're going to vastly increase the amount. See, a nuclear power plant, the reactor creates a much higher percentage of the long-lived fission products like strontium-90 and cesium-137 than a nuclear detonation does. But nuclear detonations, that if the fireball touches the surface of the Earth, it vaporizes. It can vaporize millions of tons of surface. And all that matter becomes ionized in the fireball and radioactive. So you have much higher levels of fallout if you use ground bursts, they call them, instead of the air bursts or that maybe occurs, say, a mile over the target. Those are done to maximize the blast effects because it creates a double shockwave that blow. Because war planners are always worried about hard targets. They want to destroy. You know, I made my fire zone maps way back when just to show fire, because if an ordinary person, you're not really worried about if the building's going to be blown down. But if you're in the fire zone, you're going to die. So anyway, that's a really long answer. But the issue of radioactivity will be greatly compounded if nuclear reactors are targeted. And one last word on that, you don't have to use a nuclear bomb to destroy a nuclear power plant. If North Korea hit the nuclear reactors that Japan has on its east coast, the wind would blow the fallout. It would make Japan uninhabitable. So, you know, I always question the idea that nuclear power is safe and clean simply for those kind of reasons.
Yeah. And you also mentioned sort of this idea of the sun being blocked out. And we hear, I want to get your thoughts on this idea of geoengineering and Bill Gates, and people want to, you know, shoot out sulfur into the stratosphere and block out the sun. And just, you know, going back to what you were saying, we would live in an ice age. I mean, at that point, if there was this, you know, nuclear winter and all out nuclear war, you know, at least we solved global warming, man-made global warming. But what are your thoughts on these ideas?
Well, the collateral damage from that would be most of the human race.
Right.
So
your thoughts on them wanting to actively, sort of block out the sun using
geoengineering is kind of one of the authors of these studies, Dr. Alan Robach at Rutgers, has written articles for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists on geoengineering, but he doesn't recommend it. You know, he doesn't think that that's really the way to approach a solution to global warming. You know, anytime you have a technological intervention, the bigger it is, the more side effects it has. Like when they built the Aswan Dam, well, they didn't think about what would happen to the parasitic diseases, snail fever, that would result from all the water backup. There's all kinds of things that we don't necessarily know are going to happen. And that's why, like, those type of experiments are best left undone, including nuclear war. We know what's going to, you know, nuclear bombs are designed to, they're the most destructive weapons we've ever created. You know, technically, there's no limit to the explosive power of a nuclear weapon. And look at the Poseidon drones that Russia's created and are deploying in their subs. You know, are you familiar with those?
A little bit, but please, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, they're like 90 feet long, and they can travel over 100 miles per hour, you know, faster than any U.S. torpedoes. They're powered by a nuclear reactor, nuclear engine, so they can have almost unlimited range. They could be sent off a coast and loiter. When Russia first allowed information about these to escape, it was in a briefing. It was deliberate, I'm sure. You know, it showed that it had a 100 megaton warhead. And I think that's possible. You know, the Tsar Bomba that the Soviet Union detonated in 61, I think it was, it would have had an explosive power of 100 megatons, but they put a lead jacket on it. It still was enough to, you know, it would have ignited fires over like, what, 6,000 or 7,000 square miles. I mean, these are incredibly destructive. They're almost unimaginably destructive. So if you have, you know, a 5 megaton or 20 megaton or 100 megaton warhead that's on the surface of the ocean right off a coastal area where there's a large city, when that detonates, it's going to create this enormous tidal wave that's like hundreds of feet tall, traveling hundreds of miles an hour. Maybe 1,000 feet tall. I don't know. And they can salt those with radioactive, like cobalt, which will make the waves highly radioactive. So it will not only completely destroy, you know, those would go inland for probably 100 miles or so. They'll utterly destroy anything in their way. And it would make it, be like the Romans salting the earth after they destroyed Carthage. You know, you wouldn't, you know, they've known how to do this for a long time with ships. They could sink a ship off the coast of a country and detonate it with a signal a year later from a satellite. But I never wrote about that. I read about that in the 1980s. It was written by an Air Force colonel that wrote a book called No Place to Hide. But I thought, I don't even want to talk about this. This is such a nightmare. I don't want to give anybody any ideas, but I think it's a little too late for that now. So that's what nuclear war could wind up being if these idiots decide they want to threaten, you know, make Russia back down. How many people in the United States can find Ukraine on a map?
Yeah,
I get worked up about this. When I talk about this stuff, it's hard not to get a little emotional and just, you know, so.
Yeah, and it's, these crazy times that we're living in. And another thing I wanted to touch on, this is what you've been working on lately. And I rewatched this week a 2013 briefing by former CIA Director James Woolsey, which was introduced by Dr. Peter Pry, who's been a guest on my TNT radio show last year. And I think Dr. Peter Pry was heading up the EMP task force. And I've heard people talk about using, I don't know, mini nukes or something that are exploded in the sky as a form of like EMP blast to take out all of the, you know, electrical systems. And then, you know, apart from nuclear war, what are your thoughts on, because there's a little bit more people discussing the threat of EMPs, whether it's from, you know, a solar flare event, like a natural event, or some man-made situation.
Yeah, I've been working on a paper on this for 4 years. It's just, I'm finishing it right now, and I hope to have it up on my website in a matter of a week or so. So electromagnetic pulse can be, if it's caused at high altitude nuclear detonation, which is say about 60 miles up above the surface of the Earth, the gamma rays from that detonation rip the electrons off the air molecules and send them spinning towards the Earth at the speed of light. And in 2 billionths of a second, these gigantic electromagnetic fields, which will cover tens of thousands of square miles, will basically fry any modern electronic device, integrated circuits, especially if anything's connected to the grid. This whole subject has been kind of dismissed because it was considered a neocon issue. But you know, the 2008 EMP commission, it was a congressional commission, was very authoritative. You know, they used the best studies and science, and they confirmed, you know, the danger of this. You know, the U.S. national electric grid is really fragile. It's old. But in order to send electric energy over long distances, you have to have what they call large power transformers and high-speed circuit breakers that at the plant, they step up. They step up the voltage and transmit it, and then they step it down where the receiving end. But without those large power transformers, you have no grid. And an EMP, the E3 component, will basically, by all means of scientific measurement, it will destroy the majority. One single nuclear detonation will destroy the majority of the large power transformers in the United States, like at least half of the U.S. It'll bring down the grid. And, you know, the United States imports about 82% of its large power transformers. We make some in the U.S., but if the grid's knocked down, we're not going to be able to make them here. So the current lead time, the waiting time to get a large power transformer manufactured overseas is 18 to 24 months. And then they weigh between 400,000 and 800,000 pounds. So you can't fly them by air. So they got to be shipped by sea. And then anything over 200,000 pounds is too big to be transported by rail. So they have to be sent, you know, very slowly across the country, and you have to take down power lines and power lights just to get them anywhere. it would take, you know, a year or longer probably to get these things reinstalled. So that whole time, the United States would be without electricity. And the second part of my paper has to do with the effects on the emergency power and the emergency cooling systems at nuclear power plants, because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has maintained for a long time that these plants are safe. They won't be affected by EMP. But, you know, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Air University actually published two papers that kind of disputed that. And they even forced the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to have hearings, I think, in 2019. But the NRC is like, no, it's not a problem. You know, you can look up the 2019 Air University report on the internet and look at Appendix 1 and see what the questions they asked. But I got about a 75-page paper with almost 300 footnotes that shows that the NRC is wrong. And so what would happen is the reactors would be able to shut down. They'd have an emergency shutdown because the EMP would knock out the grid. And once you lose all offsite power, there's going to be an emergency shutdown in a nuclear power plant. So that works. It doesn't require electricity. But after that, you know, the reactors usually have a couple hundred thousands of gallons of water per minute going through the reactor core. The reactor core is like maybe 30 feet tall, 15 feet wide. It's not really big. And they're doing that. They can boil like 36,000 gallons of water per minute when it's operating at full power. That's a lot of heat. So once it's shut down, there's still about 7% of heat left in the reactor core, which is a couple hundred megawatts of heat for a large commercial power plant. Well, the emergency cooling systems at a power plant are designed to kick in within 3 to 10 seconds after an emergency shutdown, because they have to remove that heat or else the core is going to self-destruct. Well, if the emergency diesel generators and the battery banks are disabled from EMP, which I believe they will be, and then all the various components within these cooling systems, within the pump, motor-driven pumps, the motor-operated valves, the temperature and pressure sensors, and the SCADA control units that direct everything from the control room and the plant, those are all going to get fried. And once the plant uses electric power, it's going to be operating in the dark. They won't have any communication systems. The cell phones won't work because that the grid's going to be down. So the plant operators are going to be in the dark trying to communicate with people that are someplace else on the plant trying to get it, the emergency diesel generators to work. The reactors are going to melt down. And you could have a single EMP, high altitude electromagnetic pulse, could melt dozens of nuclear reactors down simultaneously. You know, France has over 50 nuclear reactors. And I think like one EMP over France would probably cause most of those reactors to melt down and self-destruct. Can you imagine that? So, you know, I realize, you know, and EMP, they say, oh, well, if there's going to be an EMP, there's going to be a nuclear war anyway, and nobody's going to worry about EMP. Well, how do they know that? You can, they have what they call an asymmetric response, you know. And countries that aren't happy with the United States, like, for example, the neocons point to this, but it's legitimate. North Korea's got satellites that orbit over the United States every couple of days. They're supposed to be communication satellites, but they've never been seen to give out any communications. Why would they launch those? You know. Well, that's my rant on EMP. But I really am worried about that because I think, and the reason I wrote the paper is because they're actually technological devices, shielding that you can use for the large power transformers and the nuclear power plants. That will protect the large power transformers, will prevent the grid from being knocked down, and will basically greatly reduce, if not eliminate, the threat to the nuclear power plants from EMP. But they don't want to spend money. We can spend, you know, $120 billion to Ukraine. We can send that, but we won't spend $10 or $30 billion to protect all the U.S. national infrastructure from EMP.
Yeah, that's absurd. And that would be almost as bad a scenario as thermonuclear war. I mean, we'd be brought back basically to, you know, medieval times, to Mad Max scenario. I've had guests in the past, like Brandon Weikart, who's written a great book on space war, talk about some of these issues, like these satellites you just mentioned from North Korea or other countries that are floating about that could be disguised EMP weapons. Any quick thought on this whole hubbub of this China spy balloon floating across the U.S.? Any thoughts on that?
You know, Major David Stuckenberg wrote a report that included a high altitude weather balloon as a means to deliver a nuclear weapon to a point, because, you know, it's not like hitting a missile silo. You don't have to be highly accurate. You just have to get it basically at the right altitude in a general geographic region to detonate. I don't know. You know, you can use a Scud missile launched off the deck of a freighter off the coast of the U.S. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to do this. And there's, you know, with more than 12,000 nuclear weapons in the world, if it only takes one to knock out the grid at this point, if they're too stupid to protect the large power transformers, then, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's like, again, it's all magical thinking, I guess. I don't know. I'm astounded by all this, you know, but maybe I'm naive. You know, I always had this Mr. Smith goes to Washington idea that if I could just warn people about all this. I gave a talk to the first committee at the UN in 2010, and I showed, you know, some of the images I have in my videos that are posted about the effects of, you know, long-term environmental consequences of nuclear war. I do think that the non-nuclear weapon states took this to heart. You know, they did pass a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, a ban treaty, because the non-nuclear weapon states kind of woke up to the fact that their populations are just as much at risk from a U.S., Russia, China nuclear war as anybody else. So it's only the brainwashed people in charge and inhabiting the countries that have the nuclear weapons that aren't worried about it.
Well,
how do we get through that? You know,
some of them have those elites, neocons, whoever, they've got, you know, bunkers, and, you know, they think maybe after a while they'll be okay. And I can't even imagine, as you said, in the non-nuclear states, the chain reactions, I mean, from the economic collapse to, that alone would impoverish and kill.
We won't be able to grow food crops for many, many years. And right now the world grain reserves have enough grain to feed the people for a few months. But, you know, even the scientists did a study on a nuclear war between India and Pakistan that had 100 atomic bombs detonated, a total of 100 atomic bombs detonated in the large cities of India and Pakistan. At the time they did a study, people made fun of it because, well, that's about how many weapons they have. Well, now that's about a third of the weapons they have because they have a nuclear arms race going on there, too. But they found that it would put 5 to 7 million tons of soot and smoke in the stratosphere, and that would be enough to block about 7 to 10% of the sunlight. It would create the coldest average weather conditions in the last 1,000 years. That would be twice as cold as the year without summer in 1816 that followed the Mount Tambora volcanic eruption. And that year, they had snows in New England and the United States every month of the summer of the year. So, and there was famine in Europe. There wasn't here because we had, population spread out over a continent. But so that's a war with 100 atomic bombs. That was actually of more interest at the United Nations when I was talking there, because people had just gotten used to the idea of the U.S. and Russian arsenals. It's like, well, everybody knows nuclear weapons are dangerous and there's not going to be U.S.-Russian nuclear war. Well, I'm not sure if they would say the same thing about that right now.
it's unbelievable. And, given everything that we talked about, I always tend to ask my guests, solutions, what do we do? I guess what you're doing, raising hell about the nuclear issue as well as the EMP. Any further thoughts on what do we do about all of this?
Well, there needs to be a lot of pressure to keep the United States out of Ukraine. Don't send our troops to Western Ukraine. We're not going to win a war with China either. They have a few hundred nuclear weapons, so maybe they consider that a better first strike target. But the ICBMs that China does have, they have multi-megaton warheads on them that will ignite 700-800 square miles instantly. We want one of those landing in your neighborhood. I keep thinking, how could we win a trade war against a country that we rely on for all our pharmaceutical products? If I live in a red state, we have Walmart here, like 70-80% of the stuff in Walmart comes from China. Again, it's like, what kind of thought process is going on? And think about what we could do with this money. We have so many problems with human needs that are unmet and infrastructure that's crumbling. And all these idiots can think about is spending more and more money on war and war. It's just like they're hypnotized. I'd say turn off your damn TV. Don't listen to MSM anymore. Because all we get now is propaganda. And I think even the war narrative on Ukraine is starting to crumble because the Ukrainian army is about ready to collapse. You wouldn't hear that. You don't hear that on CNN, I don't think. But what happens when it does? We just declare victory and leave, I guess. I don't know. But you have to go beyond mainstream media to get your information these days. You cannot rely. The biggest problem I have with people that are former colleagues that won't talk to me anymore is because they get all their information from the New York Times. They believe it. It's all true. If it's there, it's got to be true. Well, maybe it was half true 20 years ago, but of course it's not all untrue, but the problem is they deliberately create these false narratives that are really like very sophisticated psyops. And if you have enough of those in your head, your worldview is so skewed that you really have no idea what's going on. So that's why shows like yours are really important, even if they get banned from YouTube or whatever. PayPal won't help you anymore, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But,
is that reflective of a free and democratic society? I don't think so.
Yeah, I've had that same experience. I used to teach at the top school here in Mexico. By the way, the only university in all of Latin America officially invited to the World Economic Forum most recently. But I've had the same approach with people people that I knew in that area, in the academia university. And they live in a completely alternate reality. And what you mentioned about PayPal, I still can't believe that less than a year ago, the Department of Homeland Security banned me from PayPal, which means that I am having just little old me. I'm having enough of an effect that I'm deemed, shut off the spigots to this guy, which is pretty crazy. But final thought?
The fact that the Department of Homeland Security can dictate what PayPal does tells you a lot about what's going on. These are not free, independent corporate entities that are working to distribute information to educate and inform the American and the world public. Are far from it. And that's the problem. Everything has become, I if you look what's happening in Germany, they it's a 3-year, you know, the Alina Lip. I mean, they what did they censor her to 3 years in prison for even reporting what was happening in Donbass?
Well, they shut off her account. Her parents' account. They shut off Alina Lip's parents' bank account. So it has nothing to do with anything.
I watched one of her videos and it was, she goes, look at what's happening. You know, she was equating, you know, the Russians and that with the Jews. You know, if you use the words interchangeably, it's, you know, it's all Russophobia is racism. And that's what these woke people in the United States and the West need to understand. They are entirely racist if they condemn an entire people.
Yeah.
And anyway, I don't know. That's what I try to tell people when they start telling me about the evil Russians. I'm like, what are you saying? You know, are you talking about the evil Negroes and the evil Jews or the evil Russians? I mean, get with it. You know, wake up. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, I've been saying for the last couple of years, I mean, even when I was teaching history a decade ago, that we're coming up on another 1930s moment, you know, like a economic collapse, tyranny rising, you know, World War III scenario. And it looks like, you know, again, we're headed in that direction. And I'll include all of your links in the description. But if you want to let us know, you know, where are the best places, the best website, what websites that you have or projects that we can follow?
You mentioned I have nuclearfamine.org. And, you know, it's not perfect, but you can get a lot of information about the effects of nuclear war there. I am going to post my EMP article on there pretty soon, and I'm going to send it to a few other people. I've created an executive summary on that, so you don't have to read the whole thing. But I made the text go into great detail about this because I'm quite sure that it's going to be belittled by, you know, the powers that be that don't want to spend the money to protect the large power transformers and nuclear reactors in the United States. But yeah, so we'll keep up the good work. I really appreciate the fact that you invited me here. And I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think we could stop it. I mean, if I'd given up hope, I'd just be out in the yard right now working.
Meanwhile,
I mean, there's so many, the earth is a beautiful place. You know, there's so many wonderful living things. And besides our children, I mean, and, you know, all these other creatures, they could care less about the arguments of humans, but we're going to wipe them out. Along with ourselves, if we have this damn nuclear war, we got to turn around from this and start devoting our intelligence and our resources to improving the lot of humanity and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I wouldn't be doing this podcast either, as you said, if I didn't think we could change some things. And I guess when you don't see the podcast anymore, I've escaped to the jungles of Chiapas or something. And so anyways, thank you, Professor Starr, for being on Geopolitics
Empire. Thank you. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms, Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem, SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.